was a medieval warlord, sitting with his soldiers and their prostitutes in the castle he had captured. A wooden staff banged on the floor, and a herald cried, "My lord, Magister Edward de Jans." Turning, she saw Johnston shoved through the crowd toward the table at the front. Lord Oliver looked up, wiping gravy from his jowls with the back of his hand. "I bid you welcome, Magister Edwardus, though I do not know if you are magister or magicien." "Lord Oliver," the professor said, speaking in Occitan. He gave a slight nod of the head. "Magister, why so cool?" Oliver said, pretending to pout. "You wound me, you do. What have I done to deserve this reserve? Are you displeased I brought you from the monastery? You shall eat as well here, I assure you. Better. Anywise, the abbot has no need of you, and I do." Johnston stood erect and did not speak. "You have nothing to say?" Oliver said, glaring at Johnston. His face darkened. "That will change," he hissed. Johnston remained unmoving, silent. The moment passed. Lord Oliver seemed to collect himself. He smiled blandly. "But come, come, let us not quarrel." "With all courtesy and respect, I seek your counsel," Oliver said. "You are wise, and I have much need of wisdom, so these worthies tell me." Guffaws at the table. "And I am told you can see the future." "No man sees that," Johnston said. "Oh, so? I think you do, Magister. And I pray you, see your own. I would not see a man of your distinction suffer much. Know you how your namesake, our late king, Edward the Foolish, met his end? I see by your face that you do. Yet you were not among those present in the castle, and I was." He smiled grimly and sat back in his chair. "There was never a mark upon his body." Johnston nodded slowly. His screams could be heard for miles. Kate looked questioningly to Merrick, who whispered, "They're talking about Edward II of England. He was imprisoned and killed. His captors didn't want any sign of foul play, so they stuck a tube up his rectum and inserted a red-hot poker into his bowels until he died." Kate shivered. "He was also gay," Merrick whispered, "so it was thought the manner of his execution demonstrated great wit." "Indeed, his screams were heard for miles," Oliver was saying. "So think on it. You know many things, and I would know them too. You are my counselor, or you are not long for this world." Lord Oliver was interrupted by a knight who slipped down the table and whispered in his ear. This knight was richly dressed in maroon and gray, but he had the tough, weathered face of a campaigner. A deep scar, almost a welt, ran down his face from forehead to chin and disappeared into his high collar. Oliver listened and then said to him, "Oh, you think so, Robert?" At this, the scarred knight whispered again, never taking his eyes off the professor. Lord Oliver was also staring at the professor while he listened. "Well, we shall see," Lord Oliver said. The stocky knight continued to whisper, and Oliver nodded. Standing in the crowd, Merrick turned to the courtier beside him and, speaking in Occitan, said, "Pray, what worthy now has Sir Oliver's ear?" "Faith, friend, this is Sir Robert de Kerr." "De Kerr," Merrick said, "I do not know of him." "He is new to retinue, not yet in service a year, but he has found much favor in Sir Oliver's eyes."
"Oh, so? Why is that?"
The man shrugged wearily as if to say, "Who knows why things happen at high table?" But he answered, "Sir Robert has a martial disposition, and he has been a trusted advisor to Lord Oliver on matters of warfare." The man lowered his voice.
"But, certes, I think he cannot be pleased to see another advisor, and one so eminent, before him now."
"Ah," Merrick said, nodding, "I understand."
Sir Robert did indeed seem to be pressing his case, whispering urgently, until finally Oliver made a quick flicking sign with one hand, as if brushing away a mosquito. Instantly the knight bowed and stepped back, standing behind Sir Oliver. Oliver said, "Magister, my lord, I am informed that you know the method of Greek fire." Standing in the crowd, Merrick snorted. He whispered to Kate, "No one knows that." And no one did. Greek fire was a famous historical conundrum, a devastating incendiary weapon from the 6th century A.D., the precise nature of which was debated by historians even now. No one knew what Greek fire really was or how it was made.
"Yes," Johnston said, "I know this method."
Merrick stared. What was this? Clearly the professor had recognized a rival, but this was a dangerous game to be playing. He would undoubtedly be asked to prove it.
"You can yourself make Greek fire," Oliver said.
"My lord, I can."
"Ah."
Oliver turned and shot a glance back at Sir Robert. It seemed the trusted advisor had given wrong advice. Oliver turned back to the professor.
"It will not be difficult," the professor said, "if I have my assistance."
So that's it, Merrick thought. The professor was making promises in an attempt to get them all together.
Assistance? You have assistance?
I do, my lord, and, well, of course they can assist you, Magister. And if they do not, we shall provide you whatever help you need. Have no concern there. But what of dew fire, the fire of Nathos? You know it as well?
I do, my lord.
And by demonstration you will show it to me?
Whenever you wish, my lord.
Very good, Magister, very good. Lord Oliver paused, looking intently at the professor.
And you also know the one secret that I wish to know above all others?
Sir Oliver, that secret I do not know.
You do, and you will answer me, he shouted, banging down a goblet.
His face was bright red, the veins standing out on his forehead. His voice echoed in the hall, which had gone suddenly silent.
I will have your answer this day.
One of the small dogs on the table cringed. With the back of his hand, he smacked it, sending it yelping to the floor. When the girl beside him started to protest, he swore and slapped her hard across the face, the blow knocking her, chair and all, on her back. The girl did not make a sound or move. She remained motionless, her feet up in the air.
Oh, I am wroth. I am sore wroth.
Sir Oliver snarled, standing up. He looked around him angrily, his hand on his sword, his eyes sweeping the great hall as if seeking some culprit. Everyone inside the hall was silent, unmoving, staring down at their feet. It was as if the room had suddenly become a still life, in which only Lord Oliver moved. He puffed in fury, finally took out his sword, and crashed the blade down on the table. Plates and goblets jumped and clattered, the sword buried in the wood. Oliver glared at the professor, but he was gaining control, his fury passing.
Magister, you will do my bidding, he cried.
Then he nodded to the guards, take him away and give him cause to meditate. Roughly, guards grabbed the professor and hauled him back through the silent crowds. Kate and Merrick stepped aside as he passed, but the professor did not see them. Lord Oliver glared at the silent room.
Be seated and be merry, he snarled, before I am in temper.
Immediately the musicians began to play, and the noise of the crowd filled the hall. Soon after, Robert de Cair hurried out of the room, following the professor. Merrick thought that departure meant nothing good. He nudged Kate, indicating that they should follow de Cair. They were moving toward the door when the herald's staff banged on the floor.
My lord, the Lady Claire de Eltham and Squire Christopher de Hughes.
They paused.
Hell,
Merrick said. A beautiful young woman came into the hall, with Chris Hughes walking at her side. Chris was now wearing expensive, courtly clothes. He looked very distinguished and very confused. Standing beside Kate, Merrick tapped his ear and whispered, "Chris, as long as you're in this room, don't speak and don't act. Do you understand?" Chris nodded slightly. "Behave as if you don't understand anything. It shouldn't be difficult." Chris and the woman passed through the crowd and walked directly before the high table, where Lord Oliver watched her approach with open annoyance. The woman saw it, dipped low, and stayed there, close to the ground, head bowed in submission. "Come, come," Lord Oliver said irritably, waving a drumstick. "This obsecration ill suits you."
"My lord."
She rose to her feet. Oliver snorted. "And what have you dragged in with you today? Another dazzled conquest?"
"If it please my lord, I present you Christopher of Hughes, a squire of Ire, who saved me from villains who would have kidnapped me today, or worse."
"Eh? Villains? Kidnapped?" Amused, Lord Oliver looked down the table at his knights. "Sir Guy, what say you?" A dark-complected man stood angrily. Sir Guy de Maligon was dressed entirely in black, black chain mail and a black surcoat, with a black eagle embroidered on his chest. "My lord, I fear my lady amuses herself at our expense. She knows full well I set my men to save her, seeing that she was alone and in distress." Sir Guy walked toward Chris, glaring at him. "It is this man, my lord, who placed her at risk of her life. I cannot think she now defends him, except as display of her uncommon wit."
"Eh?" Oliver said. "Wit? My Lady Claire, what wit is here?"
The woman shrugged. "Only the witless, my lord, see wit where none is writ." The dark knight snorted. "Quick words to quick conceal what lies beneath." Maligon walked up to Chris until they were standing face to face, inches apart. He stared intensely as he slowly, deliberately began to take off his chain mail glove. "Squire Christopher, is it how you are called?" Chris said nothing, only nodded. Chris was terrified. Trapped in a situation he did not understand, standing in a room full of bloodthirsty soldiers, no better than a bunch of street-corner thugs, and facing this dark, angry man whose breath stank of rotting teeth, garlic, and wine, it was all he could do to keep his knees from shaking. Through his earpiece he heard Merrick say, "Don't speak, no matter what." Sir Guy squinted at him. "I asked of you a question, squire. Will you answer?" He was still taking off his glove, and Chris felt sure he was about to hit him with his bare fist. Merrick said, "Don't speak." Chris was only too happy to follow that advice. He took a deep breath, trying to control himself. His legs were tremulous, rubbery. He felt as if he might collapse in front of this man. He did his best to steady himself. Another deep breath. Sir Guy turned to the woman. "Madam, does he speak, your savior squire, or merely sigh?"
"If it please Sir Guy, he is of foreign parts, and often does not comprehend our tongue."
"Dic mihi nomen tuum, scutari." "Tell me your name."
"Nor Latin, I fear, Sir Guy."
Maligon looked disgusted. "Commodissime. Most convenient, this dumb squire, for we cannot ask how he comes here and for what purpose. This Irish squire is far from home, and yet he is not a pilgrim. He is not in service. What is he? Why is he here? See how he trembles. What can he fear? Nothing from us, my lord, unless he be the creature of Arnaud, come to see how the land lies. This would make him dumb. A coward would not dare speak."
Merrick whispered, "Do not respond."
Maligon poked Chris hard on the chest. "So, cowardly squire, I call you spy and scoundrel, and not man enough to admit your true cause. I would have contempt for you were you not beneath it." The knight finished removing his glove, and with a disgusted shake of his head, he dropped it on the floor.
The chainmail glove landed with a clunk on Chris's toes. Sir Guy turned insolently away and started back to the table. Everyone in the room was staring at Chris. Beside him, Claire whispered, "The glove." He glanced at her sideways. "The glove? What about the glove?" he wondered as he bent over and picked it up. It felt surprisingly heavy in his hand. He held the glove out to Claire, but she had already turned away, saying, "Knight, the squire has accepted your challenge." Chris thought, "What challenge?" Sir Guy said immediately, "Three lances untipped, à outrance." Merrick said, "You poor bastard, do you know what you just did?" Sir Guy turned to Lord Oliver at the high table. "My lord, I pray you let the day's tourney begin with our challenge combat."
"So it shall be," Oliver said.
Sir Daniel slipped forward through the crowd and bowed.
"My lord Oliver, my niece carries this jest too far, with unworthy result. It may amuse her to see Sir Guy, a knight of renown, provoked into combat with a mere squire, and so dishonored by the doing. But it ill serves Sir Guy to be taken in by her ruse."
"Is this so?" Lord Oliver said, looking at the dark knight. Sir Guy Maligon spat on the floor. "A squire? Mark me, this is no squire.
Here is a knight in hiding,
a knave and a spy. His deceit shall have its reward. I will contest him this day."
Sir Daniel said, "If it please my lord, I think it is not meet. Sooth, he is a squire only, of little training at arms, and no match for your worthy knight."
Chris was still trying to understand what was going on when Merrick stepped forward, speaking fluently in a foreign language that sounded something like French, but not exactly. He guessed it was Occitan. Chris heard the translation in his earpiece.
"My lord," Merrick said, bowing smoothly, "this worthy gentleman speaks truth. Squire Christopher is my companion, but he is no warrior. In fairness, I ask you to allow Christopher to name a champion in his stead to meet this challenge."
"Eh? Champion? What champion? I do not know you."
Chris saw that Lady Claire was staring at Merrick with unconcealed interest. He returned a brief glance before speaking to Oliver.
"Please, my lord, I am Sir Andre de Merrick, late of Hainaut. I offer myself as his champion, and God willing I shall give good account with this noble knight."
Lord Oliver rubbed his chin, thinking. Seeing his indecision, Sir Daniel pressed forward.
"My lord, to begin your tourney with unequal combat does not enhance the day, nor make it memorable in the minds of men. I think de Merrick will give better sport."
Lord Oliver turned back to Merrick to see what he would say to that.
"My lord," Merrick said, "if my friend Christopher is a spy, then so am I. In defaming him, Sir Guy has defamed me as well, and I beg leave to defend my good name."
Lord Oliver seemed entertained by this new complication.
"How say you, Guy?"
"Faith," the Dark Knight said, "I grant you this de Merrick may be a worthy second, if his arm has the skill of his tongue. But as a second, it is meet he fight my second, Sir Charles de Gaune." A tall man stood at the end of the table. He had a pale skin, a long face, a thin nose, and close-set eyes. He resembled a rat. But his body was strong, and his tone contemptuous as he said,
"I shall be second with pleasure."
Merrick made one final attempt. "So," he said, "it appears Sir Guy is afraid to fight me first."
At this, the Lady Claire openly smiled at Merrick. She was clearly interested in him, and it seemed to annoy Sir Guy.
"I fear no man," Guy said, "least of all an otter. If you survive my second, which I much doubt, then I will gladly fight you after, and bring your insolence to an end."
"So be it,"
Lord Oliver said, and turned away. His tone indicated
that the discussion was ended.
32 hours, 6 minutes, 1 second. The horses wheeled and charged, racing past each other on the grassy field. The ground shook as the big animals thundered past Merrick and Chris, who were standing at the low fence, watching the practice runs. To Chris, the tournament field was huge, the size of a football field, and on two sides the stands had been completed and ladies were beginning to be seated. Spectators from the countryside, roughly dressed and noisy, lined the rail. Another pair of riders charged, their horses snorting as they galloped. Merrick said, "How well do you ride?" He shrugged. "I rode with Sophie." "Then I think I can keep you alive, Chris," Merrick said. "But you must do exactly as I tell you." "All right." "So far you haven't been doing what I tell you," Merrick reminded him. "This time you must."
"Okay, okay."
"All you have to do," Merrick said, "is stay mounted on the horse long enough to take the hit. Sir Guy will have no choice but to aim for the chest when he sees how badly you ride, because the chest is the largest and steadiest target on a galloping rider. I want you to take his lance square on the chest on the breastplate. You understand?"
"I take his lance on the chest,"
Chris said, looking very unhappy. "When the lance strikes, you let yourself be unseated. It shouldn't be difficult. Fall to the ground and do not move, so you appear to have been knocked unconscious, which you may be. Under no circumstances get to your feet. Do you understand?"
"Don't get to my feet."
"That's right. No matter what happens, you continue to lie there. If Sir Guy has unhorsed you and you are unconscious, the match is over. But if you get up, he will call for another lance, or he will fight you on foot with broadswords and kill you."
"Don't get up,"
Chris repeated. "That's right," Merrick said. "No matter what, don't get up." He clapped Chris on the shoulder. "With luck, you'll survive just fine."
"Jesus,"
Chris said. More horses charged past them, shaking the ground. Leaving the field behind, they passed among the many tents arranged outside the tournament ground. The tents were small and round, boldly colored with stripes and zigzag designs. Pennants rippled in the air above each tent. Horses were tied up outside. Pages and squires scurried to and fro, carrying armor, saddles, hay, water. Several pages were rolling barrels over the ground. The barrels made a soft, hissing sound. "That's sand," Merrick explained. "They roll the chainmail in sand to remove rust."
"Uh-huh."
Chris tried to focus on details, trying to take his mind off what was to come, but he felt as if he were going to his own execution. They entered a tent where three pages were waiting. A warming fire burned in one corner. The armor was laid out on a ground cloth. Merrick inspected it briefly, then said, "It's fine." He turned to leave.
"Where are you going?"
"To another tent, to dress."
"But I don't know how..."
"The pages will dress you," Merrick said, and left. Chris looked at the armor lying in pieces on the ground, especially at the helmet, which had one of those pointy snouts like a large duck. There was only a little slit for the eyes, but beside it was another helmet, more ordinary-looking, and Chris thought that, "Good, my squire, if it please you." The head page, slightly older and better dressed than the others, was talking to him. He was a boy of about 14. "I pray you, stand here." He pointed to the center of the tent. Chris stood, and he felt many hands moving over his body. They quickly removed all his clothes down to his linen undershirt and breeches, and then there were murmurs of concern as they saw his body. "Have you been sick, squire?" one asked.
No.
"A fever or an illness to so weaken your body as we see it now?"
"No,"
Chris said, frowning. They began to dress him, saying nothing. First, thick felt leggings, and then a heavily padded long-sleeved undershirt that buttoned at the front. They told him to bend his arms. He could hardly do it, the cloth was so thick. "It is stiff from washing, but it will soon be easier," one said. Chris didn't think so. "Jesus," he thought, "I can hardly move, and they haven't put on the armor yet." Now they were strapping plates of metal on his thighs, calves, and knees. Then they continued with his arms, As each piece went on, they asked him to move his limbs to be sure the straps were not too tight. Next, a coat of chain mail was lowered over his head. It felt surprisingly heavy on his shoulders. While the breastplate was being tied in place, the head page asked a series of questions, none of which Chris could answer. Do you sit high or in kettle? Will you couch your lance or rest it? Do you tie brace the high pommel or sit free? Set your stirrups low or forward? Chris made non-committal noises. Meanwhile, more pieces of armor were added with more questions. Flex sabaton or firm? Vambrace guard or sideplate? Broadsword left or right? Bassinet beneath your helm or no? He felt increasingly burdened as more weight was added and increasingly stiff as each joint was encased in metal. The pages worked quickly, and in a matter of minutes he was entirely dressed. They stepped away and surveyed him. "'Tis good, squire."
"It is," he said.
"Now the helm."
He was already wearing a kind of metal skullcap, but now they brought over the pointy snout helmet and placed it over his head. Chris was plunged into darkness, and he felt the helmet's weight on his shoulders. He could see nothing except what was straight ahead through a horizontal eye slit. His heart began to pound. There was no air. He couldn't breathe. He tugged at the helmet, trying to lift the visor, but it did not move. He was trapped. He heard his breathing amplified in the metal. His hot breath warmed the tight confines of the helmet. He was suffocating. There was no air. He grabbed at the helmet, struggling to remove it. The pages lifted it off his head and looked at him curiously. "Is all well, squire?" Chris coughed and nodded, not trusting himself to speak. He never wanted that thing on his head again. But already they were leading him out of the tent to a waiting horse. "Jesus Christ," he thought. The horse was gigantic and covered in more metal than he was. There was a decorated plate over the head and more plates on the chest and sides. Even in armor, the animal was jumpy and high-spirited, snorting and jerking at the reins the page held. This was a true war horse, a destrier, and it was far more spirited than any horse he had ever ridden before. But that was not what concerned him. What concerned him was the size. The damn horse was so big he couldn't see over it. And the wooden saddle was raised, making it still higher. The pages were all looking at him expectantly, waiting for him. To do what? Probably to climb up. "How do I,
They blinked, surprised.
The head page stepped forward and said smoothly, "Place your hand here, squire, on the wood and swing up." Chris extended his hand, but he could barely reach the pommel, a rectangle of carved wood in the front of the saddle. He closed his fingers around the wood, then raised his knee and slipped his foot in the stirrup.
I think your left foot, squire."
Of course, left foot. He knew that. He was just tense and confused. He kicked the stirrup to get his right foot free, but the armor had caught on the stirrup. He bent forward awkwardly and used his hand to tug the stirrup free. It still was stuck. Finally, at the moment of release, he lost his balance and fell on his back near the horse's rear hooves. The horrified pages quickly dragged him clear. They got him to his feet, and then they all helped him to mount. He felt hands pressing against his buttocks as he rose shakily into the air, swung his foot over, Jesus, that was hard, and landed with a clank in the saddle. Chris looked down at the ground far below. He felt as if he were 10 feet in the air. As soon as he was mounted, the horse began to whinny and shake its head, turning sideways and snapping at Hughes's legs in the stirrups. He thought, this damn horse is trying to bite me.
"Rein, squire, reins. You must rein him."
Chris tugged at the reins. The enormous horse paid no attention, pulling hard, still trying to bite him.
"Show him, squire, strongly."
Chris yanked the reins so sharply he thought he'd break the animal's neck. At this, the horse merely gave a final snort and faced forward, suddenly calmed.
"Well done, squire."
Trumpets sounded several long notes.
"That is the first call to arms," the page said. "We must to the tourney field."
They took the horse's reins and led Chris toward the grassy field. 36 hours, 2 minutes, 0 seconds. It was after midnight,
From inside his office at ITC, Robert Doniger stared down at the entrance to the cave, illuminated in the night by the flashing lights of 6 ambulances parked all around. He listened to the crackle of the paramedics' radios and watched the people leaving the tunnel. He saw Gordon walking out of the tunnel with that new kid, Stern. Neither of them appeared to have been hurt. He saw Kramer reflected in the glass of the window as she entered the room behind him. She was slightly out of breath. Without looking back at her, he said, "How many were injured?"
6. 2 somewhat seriously.
How seriously?
Shrapnel wounds, burns from toxic inhalation.
Then they'll have to go to UH. He meant University Hospital in Albuquerque.
Yes, Kramer said. But I've briefed them about what they can say. Lab accident, all that. And I called Whittle at UH, reminded him of our last donation. I don't think there'll be a problem.
Doniger stared out the window. There might be, he said.
The PR people can handle it.
Maybe not, Doniger said. In recent years, ITC had built a publicity unit of 26 people around the world. Their job was not to get publicity for the company, but rather to deflect it. ITC, they explained to anyone who inquired, was a company that made superconducting quantum devices for magnetometers and medical scanners. These devices consisted of a complex electromechanical element about 6 inches long. Press handouts were stupefyingly boring, dense with quantum specifications. For the rare reporter who remained interested, ITC enthusiastically scheduled a tour of their New Mexico facility. Reporters were taken to selected research labs. Then, in a large assembly room, they were shown how the devices were made. The gradiometer coils fitted into the cryostat, the superconducting shield, and electrical leads outside. Explanations referred to the Maxwell equations and electric charge motion. Almost invariably, reporters abandoned their stories. In the words of one, "It's about as compelling as an assembly line for hair dryers." In this way, Doniger had managed to keep silent about the most extraordinary scientific discovery of the late 20th century. In part, his silence was self-preservation. Other companies like IBM and Fujitsu had started their own quantum research, and even though Doniger had a 4-year head start on them, it was in his interest that they not know exactly how far he had gone. He also was aware that his plan was not yet completed, and he needed secrecy to finish. As he himself often said, grinning like a kid, "If people knew what we were up to, they'd really want to stop us." But at the same time, Doniger knew that he could not maintain the secrecy forever. Sooner or later, perhaps by accident, it was all going to come out. And when that happened, it was up to him to manage it. The question in Doniger's mind was whether it was happening now. He watched as the ambulances pulled out, sirens whining. "Think about it," he said to Kramer. 2 weeks ago, this company was buttoned down tight. Our only problem was that French reporter. Then we had Traub. That depressed old bastard put our whole company in jeopardy. Traub's death brought that cop from Gallup, who's still nosing around. Then Johnston, then his 4 students. And now 6 techs going to the hospital. It's getting to be a lot of people out there, Diane. A lot of exposure. "You think it's getting away from us?" she said.
"Possibly," he said. "But not if I can help it. Especially since I've got 3 potential board members coming day after tomorrow. So let's button it back down."
She nodded. "I really think we can handle this."
"Okay," he said, turning away from the window. "See that Stern goes to bed in one of the spare rooms. Make sure he gets sleep and put a block on the phone. Tomorrow I want Gordon sticking to him like glue. Give him a tour of the place, whatever, but stay with him. I want a conference call with the PR people tomorrow at 8. I want a briefing about the transit pad at 9. And I want those media dipshits at noon. Call everybody now so they can get ready."
"Right," she said. "I may not be able to keep this under control," Doniger said, "but I'm sure as hell going to try."
He frowned at the glass, watching the people clustered outside the tunnel in the dark. "How long until they can go back in the cave?"
9 hours.
"And then we can mount a rescue operation, send another team back?"
Kramer coughed.
"Well, are you sick, or does that mean no?"
"All the machines were destroyed in the explosion, Bob," she said.
"All of them?"
"I think so, yes."
"Then all we can do is rebuild the pad and sit on our asses to see if they come back in one piece?" Yes, that's right. We have no way to rescue them.
Then let's hope they know their stuff, Doniger said, because they're on their own. Good fucking luck to them.
31 hours, 40 minutes, 44 seconds. Through the narrow slit of his helmet visor, Chris Hughes could see that the tournament stands were filled, almost entirely with ladies, and the railings crowded with commoners 10 deep. Everyone was shouting for the tournament to begin. Chris was now at the east end of the field, surrounded by his pages trying to control the horse, which seemed upset by the shouting crowd and now began to buck and rear. The pages tried to hand him a striped lance, which was absurdly long and ungainly in his hand. Chris took it, then fumbled it as the horse snorted and stomped beneath him. Beyond the barrier, he saw Kate standing among the commoners. She was smiling encouragement at him, but the horse kept twisting and turning so he could not return her gaze. And not far off, he saw the armored figure of Merrick, surrounded by pages. As Chris's horse turned again, why didn't the pages grab the reins? He saw the far end of the field where Sir Guy de Maligon sat calmly on his mount. He was pulling on his black-plumed helmet. Chris's horse bucked once more and turned him in circles. He heard more trumpets, and the spectators all looked toward the stands. He was dimly aware that Lord Oliver was taking his seat to scattered applause. Then the trumpets blared again.
"Squire, it is your signal,"
a page said, handing him the lance once more. This time he managed to hold it long enough to rest it in a notch on his pommel, so that it crossed the horse's back and pointed ahead to his left. Then the horse spun, and the pages yelled and scattered as the lance swung in an arc over their heads. More trumpets. Hardly able to see, Chris tugged at his reins, trying to get the horse under control. He glimpsed Sir Guy at the far end of the field, just watching, his horse perfectly still. Chris wanted to get it over with, but his horse was wild. Angry and frustrated, he yanked hard at the reins one final time.
"God damn it, go, will you?"
At this, the horse snapped his head up and down in two swift motions, the ears went flat, and he charged. Merrick watched the charge tensely. He had not told Chris everything. There was no point in frightening him any more than necessary. But certainly Sir Guy would try to kill Chris, which meant he would aim his lance for the head. Chris was bouncing wildly in the saddle, his lance jerking up and down, his body swaying from side to side. He made a poor target, but if Sir Guy was skilled, and Merrick had no doubt that he was, then he would still aim for the head, risking a miss on the first pass in order to make the fatal hit. He watched Chris jolt down the field, precariously hanging in the saddle, and he watched Sir Guy charging toward him in perfect control, body leaning forward, lance couched in the crook of the arm. Well, Merrick thought, there was at least a chance that Chris would survive. Chris could not see much of anything. Lurching wildly in the saddle, he had only blurred views of the stands, the ground, the other rider coming toward him. From his brief glimpses, he could not estimate how far away Guy was or how long until the impact. He heard the thundering hoofbeats of his horse, the rhythmic snorting breath. He bounced in the saddle and tried to hold on to his lance. Everything was taking much longer than he expected. He felt as if he had been riding this horse for an hour. At the last moment, he saw Guy very close, rushing up to him at frightful speed, and then his own lance recoiled in his hand, slamming painfully into his right side, and simultaneously he felt a sharp pain in his left shoulder and an impact that twisted him sideways in the saddle, and he heard the crack of splintering wood. The crowd roared. He raced onward to the far end of the field. Chris was dazed. What had happened? His shoulder burned fiercely, his lance had been snapped in two, and he was still sitting in the saddle. Shit. Merrick watched unhappily. It was bad luck. The impact had been too glancing to unseat Chris. Now they would have to charge another time. He glanced over at Sir Guy, who was cursing as he pulled a fresh lance from the hands of the pages, wheeling his horse, preparing to charge again. At the far end of the field, Chris was again trying to get control of his new lance, which swung wildly in the air like a metronome. At last he brought it down across the saddle, but the horse was still twisting and bucking. Guy was humiliated and angry. He was impatient and did not wait. Kicking his spurs, he charged down the field. "You bastard," Merrick thought. The crowd roared in surprise at the one-sided attack. Chris heard it and saw that Guy was already galloping toward him at full speed. His own horse was still twisting and unruly. He jerked on the reins and at that moment heard a thwack as one of the grooms whipped his horse on the hindquarters. The horse whinnied, the ears flattened. He charged down the field. The second charge was worse, because this time he knew what was coming. The impact slammed him, streaking pain across his chest, as he was lifted bodily up into the air. Everything became slow. He saw the saddle moving away from him, then the horse's rear flanks revealed as he slid away, and then he was tilted back, staring up at sky. He smashed onto the ground, flat on his back. His head clanged against the helmet. He saw bright blue spots, which spread and grew larger, then became gray. He heard Merrick in his ear, "Now stay there." Somewhere he heard distant trumpets as the world faded gently, easily into blackness. At the far end of the course, Guy was wheeling his horse to prepare for another charge, but already the trumpets had sounded for the next pair. Merrick lowered his lance, kicked his horse, and galloped forward. He saw his opposite, Sir Charles de Gaune, racing toward him. He heard the steady rumble of the horse, the building roar of the crowd. They knew this would be good, as he raced forward. The horse was running incredibly fast. Sir Charles charged forward, equally fast. According to the medieval text, the great challenge of the joust was not to carry the lance or to aim it at this target or that. The challenge was to hold the line of the charge and not to veer away from the impact, not to give in to the panic that swept over nearly every rider as he galloped toward his opponent. Merrick had read the old text, but now he suddenly understood them. He felt shivery and loose, weak in his limbs, his thighs trembling as he squeezed his mount. He forced himself to concentrate, to focus, to line up his lance with Sir Charles. But the tip of his lance whipped up and down as he charged. He raised it from the pommel, couched it in the crook of his arm. Steadier, his breathing was better. He felt his strength return. He lined up, 80 yards now, charging hard. He saw Sir Charles adjust his lance, angling it upward. He was going for the head. Or was it a feint? Jousting riders were known to change their aim at the last moment. Would he? 60 yards. The head strike was risky if both riders were not aiming for it. A straight lance to the torso would impact a fraction of a second sooner than a lance to the head. It was a matter of the angles. The first impact would move both riders, making the head strike less certain. But a skilled knight might extend his lance farther forward, taking it out of couched position, to get 6 or 8 inches of extra length and thus the first impact. You had to have enormous arm strength to absorb the instant of impact and control the lance so it socked back, so the horse would bear the brunt, but you were more likely to throw off the opponent's aim and timing. 50 yards. Sir Charles still held his lance high, but now he couched it, leaning forward in the saddle. He had more control of the lance now. Would he feint again? 40 yards. There was no way to know. Merrick decided to go for the chest strike. He put his lance in position. He would not move it again. 30 yards. He heard the thunder of hooves, the roar of the crowd. The medieval text warned, "Do not close your eyes at the moment of impact. Keep your eyes open to make the hit." 20 yards. His eyes were open. 10. The bastard raised his lance. He was going for the head. Impact. The crack of wood sounded like a gunshot. Merrick felt a pain in his left shoulder, stabbing upward and hard. He rode on to the end of the course, dropped his shattered lance, extended his hand out for another, but the pages were just staring at the field behind him. Looking back, he saw that Sir Charles was down, lying on the ground, not moving. And then he saw Sir Guy prancing and wheeling around Chris's fallen body. That would be his solution, Merrick thought. He'd trample Chris to death. Merrick turned and drew his sword. He held it high. With a howl of rage, Merrick spurred his horse down the field. The crowd screamed and pounded the railings like a drumbeat. Sir Guy turned and he saw Merrick coming. He looked back down at Chris and kicked his horse, making it move sideways to stomp him. "Fie! Fie!" the crowd shouted, and even Lord Oliver was on his feet, aghast. But then Merrick had reached Sir Guy, unable to stop his charge, but sweeping past him, shouting, "Asshole!" as he struck Guy's head with the flat of his sword. He knew it wouldn't hurt him, but it was an insulting blow, and it would make him abandon Chris, which it did. Sir Guy immediately turned away from Chris as Merrick reined up, holding his sword. Sir Guy pulled his sword from the sheath and swung viciously, the blade whistling in the air. It clanged off Merrick's blade. Merrick felt his own sword vibrate in his hand with the impact. Merrick lashed out in a backswing, going for the head. Guy parried. The horses wheeled. The swords clanged again and again. The battle had begun. And in some detached part of his mind, Merrick knew that this would be a fight to the death. Kate watched the battle from the railing. Merrick was holding his own, and his physical strength was superior. But it was easy to see that he did not have the expertise of Sir Guy. His swings were wilder, his body position less sure. He seemed to know it, and so did Sir Guy, who kept backing his horse away, trying to open space for full swings. For his part, Merrick pressed closer, keeping the distance between them tight, like a fighter staying in the clinch. But Merrick could not do it forever, she saw. Sooner or later, Guy would get enough distance, if only for a moment, and make a lethal blow. Merrick's hair was soaked with sweat inside the helmet. Stinging drops dripped into his eyes. He could do nothing about it. He shook his head, trying to clear his vision. It didn't help much. Soon he was gasping for breath. Through the slit of the helmet, Sir Guy appeared tireless and implacable, always on the attack, swinging repeatedly in a sure, practiced rhythm. Merrick knew that he had to do something soon before he became too tired. He had to break the knight's rhythm. His right hand holding the sword already burned from constant exertion. His left hand was strong. Why not use his left hand? It was worth a try. Spurring his horse, Merrick moved closer until they were chest to chest. He waited until he had blocked one swing with his own sword, and then with the heel of his left hand, he punched upward at Sir Guy's helmet. The helmet snapped back. He felt the satisfying thunk as Guy's head struck the front of the helmet. Immediately, Merrick flipped his sword over and slammed the butt of the handle against Guy's helmet. There was a loud clang, and Guy's body jerked in the saddle. His shoulders slumped momentarily. Merrick struck again, banged the helmet harder. He knew he was hurting him, but not enough. Too late, he saw Guy's sword hiss in a broad arc toward Merrick's back. Merrick felt the brutal sting like a whip across his shoulders. Did the chain mail hold? Was he hurt? He could still move his arms. He swung his own blade hard against the back of Guy's helmet. Guy did nothing to ward off the blow, which rang like a gong. He must be dazed, Merrick thought. Merrick swung again, then wheeled his horse, coming around, and he swung broadly for the neck. Guy blocked it, but the force of the impact knocked him backward. Reeling, he slid sideways in the saddle, grabbed for the pommel, but could not prevent his fall to the ground. Merrick turned, started to dismount. The crowd roared again. Looking back, he saw that Guy had leapt easily to his feet, his injuries a sham. He swung his blade at Merrick while he was still dismounting. Merrick, with one foot still raised in the stirrup, parried awkwardly, somehow got clear of his horse, and then swung back. Sir Guy was strong, sure of himself. Merrick realized his situation was now worse than before. He attacked fiercely, but Guy backed up easily, his footwork practiced and quick. Merrick was gasping and wheezing inside his helmet. He was sure Guy could hear it and would know what it meant. Merrick was wearing down. All Sir Guy had to do was keep backing away until Merrick exhausted himself. Unless, off to the left, Chris obediently still lay flat on his back. Merrick swung at Guy, moving to the right with every stroke. Guy continued to move lightly away, but now Merrick was driving him back toward Chris. Chris awoke slowly to the clang of swords. Groggy, he took stock. He was lying on his back staring at blue sky, but he was alive. What had happened? He turned his head inside his black helmet. With just a narrow slit for vision, it was hot and stuffy and claustrophobic. He began to feel sick. The sensation of nausea built quickly. He didn't want to throw up inside the helmet. It was too tight around his head. He would drown in his own puke. He had to get his helmet off. Still lying there, he reached up and grabbed the helmet with both hands. He tugged at it. It didn't budge. Why? Had they tied it on him? Was it because he was lying down? He was going to throw up in the damn helmet. Jesus! Frantic, he rolled on the ground. Merrick swung his sword desperately. Behind Sir Guy, he saw Chris begin to move. Merrick would have shouted to him to stay where he was, but he had no breath to speak. Merrick swung again and again. Now Chris was pulling at his helmet, trying to get it off. Guy was still 10 yards from Chris, dancing backward, enjoying himself, parrying Merrick's blows easily. Merrick knew he was almost at the limits of his strength now. His swings were increasingly weak. Guy was still strong, still smooth, just backing and parrying, waiting for his chance. 5 yards. Chris had rolled over on his stomach, and he was now getting up. He was on all fours, hanging his head. There was a loud, retching sound. Guy heard it too, turned his head a little to look. Merrick charged, butted him in the breastplate with his head, and Guy staggered backward, fell over Chris, and went down. Maligant rolled quickly on the ground, but Merrick was on him, stamping on Guy's right hand to pin the sword down, then swinging his other leg over to pin the opposite shoulder. Merrick held his sword high, ready to plunge it down. The crowd fell silent. Guy did not move. Slowly, Merrick lowered his sword, cut the laces to Guy's helmet, and pushed it back with the tip of his blade. Guy's head was now exposed. Merrick saw he was bleeding freely from his left ear. Guy glared at him and spat. Merrick raised his sword again. He was filled with rage, stinging sweat, burning arms, vision red with fury and exhaustion. He tightened his hands, prepared to swing down and cut the head from the body. Guy saw it. "Mercy!" he shouted so everyone would hear. "I beg mercy," he cried. "In the name of the Holy Trinity and the Virgin Mary, mercy, mercy." The crowd was silent, waiting. Merrick was not sure what to do. In the back of his mind, a voice said, "Kill this bastard or you will regret it later." He knew that he must decide quickly. The longer he stood here, straddling Sir Guy, the more certain he would lose his nerve. He looked at the crowd lining the railing. No one moved. They just stared. He looked at the stands where Lord Oliver sat with the ladies. Everyone was motionless. Lord Oliver seemed frozen. Merrick looked back at the cluster of pages standing by the railing. They too were frozen. Then, in a move that was almost subliminal, one page raised a hand to mid-chest and made a flicking wrist motion. "Cut it off." "He's giving you good advice," Merrick thought. But Merrick hesitated. There was absolute silence in the field, except for the retches and groans of Chris. In the end, it was those retches that broke the moment. Merrick stepped away from Sir Guy and extended a hand to help him up. Sir Guy took his hand, got to his feet in front of Merrick. He said, "You bastard, I'll see you in hell," and turned on his heel and walked away.
31 hours, 15 minutes, 58 seconds. The little stream wound through mossy grass and wildflowers. Chris was on his knees, plunging his face into the water. He came back sputtering, coughing. He looked at Merrick, who was squatting beside him, staring off into space. "I've had it," Chris said. "I've had it."
"I imagine you have."
"I could have been killed," Chris said. "That's supposed to be a sport. You know what that is? It's a game of chicken on horses. Those people are insane."
He dunked his head in the water again.
"Chris, I hate to throw up. I hate it."
"Chris."
"What? What is it now? You going to tell me I'll rust my armor? Because I don't give a shit, Andre."
"No," Merrick said. "I'm going to tell you your felt undershirt will swell, and it'll be difficult to take the armor off."
"Is that right? Well, I don't care. Those pages will come and get it off me."
Chris sat back in the moss and coughed.
"Jesus, I can't get rid of that smell. I need to take a bath or something."
Merrick sat beside him, said nothing. He just let him unwind. Chris's hands were shaking as he talked. It was better for him to get it out, he thought. In the field below them, archers in maroon and gray were practicing. Ignoring the excitement of the nearby tournament, they patiently fired at targets, moved backward, fired again. It was just as the old text said. The English archers were highly disciplined, and they practiced every day.
"Those men are the new military power," Merrick said. "They decide battles now. Look at them."
Chris propped himself on his elbow.
"You're kidding," he said.
The archers were now more than 200 yards from their circular targets, the length of 2 football fields. So far away they were small figures, and yet they were confidently drawing their bows toward the sky. Are they serious? The sky was black with whistling arrows. They struck the targets or landed close by, sticking up in the grass.
"No kidding," Chris said.
Almost immediately, another thick volley filled the air, and another, and another. Merrick was counting to himself. 3 seconds between volleys. So it was true, he thought. English archers really could fire 20 rounds a minute. By now, the targets bristled with arrows.
"Charging knights can't stand up under that kind of attack," Merrick said. "It kills the riders, and it kills the horses. That's why the English knights dismount to fight. The French still charge in the traditional way, and they're just slaughtered. Before they ever get close to the English. 4,000 knights dead at Crécy, even more in Poitiers. Large numbers for this time."
"Why don't the French change tactics? Can't they see what's happening?"
"They do, but it means the end of a whole way of life, a whole culture, really," Merrick said. "Knights are all nobility. Their way of life is too expensive for commoners. A knight has to buy his armor and at least 3 war horses, and he has to support his retinue of pages and aides. And these noble knights have been the determining factor in warfare until now. Now it's over," he pointed to the archers in the field. "Those men are commoners. They win by coordination and discipline. There's no personal valor. They're paid a wage. They do a job. But they're the future of warfare. Paid, disciplined, faceless troops. The knights are finished."
"Except for tournaments," Chris said sourly.
"Pretty much. And even there, all that plate armor over the chainmail, that's all because of arrows. Arrows will go clean through an unprotected man, and they'll penetrate chainmail. So knights need plate armor. Horses need armor. But with a volley like that..."
Merrick pointed to the whistling rainfall of arrows and shrugged.
"It's over."
Chris looked back at the tournament grounds, and then he said, "Well, it's about time." Merrick turned and saw 5 liveried pages walking toward them, along with 2 guards in red and black surcoats. "Finally, I'm going to get out of this damned metal." Chris and Merrick stood as the men came up. One of the guards said,
You have broken the rules of tourney, disgraced the chivalrous knight Guy de Maligon, and the good offices of Lord Oliver. You are made arrest, and will come with us.
Wait a minute, Chris said. We disgraced him?
You will come with us.
Wait a minute, Chris said.
The soldier cuffed him hard on the side of the head, then pushed him forward. Merrick fell into step beside him. Surrounded by guards, they headed toward the castle. Kate was still at the tournament.